Thank you very much, Kun. I don't know if you want me to start now to take in the mic, maybe just to give it away to Frederic. And for us, if people in the assistants have questions, I propose them to ask it later when the two presentations are done, so we can discuss about this. Frederic, I let you take the
Yes.
mic.
Okay. Okay. Thank you very much. I share my screen as well. Can you see it? Yes. Okay. Well, I must say it's very moving to speak after Kuhn. So I don't know, it might take me a few minutes to readjust to what has been said. In a way, I just want to, I don't know, to make a kind of strange transition to make you look at this first slide that I made. Where you can see on the left a model, a kind of lens that we try to apply to the soil. And I just, again, just to try to make a link, I just like to make you aware and share with me the feeling that this very strange picture of the soil on the right side, which I will explain further, of course, is very organic. It looks very much like some kind of body, the inside of a body, and in a way, this is the point, I think, of what we try to do. So my presentation is called Mapping Soil Depth, and as you said, and thank you again very much for this invitation today. I'm very pleased to be part of this seminar. So as was said, I published 2 years ago a book called Terraforma with two architects, Alexandra Arène and Axel Grégoire. And what I will try to do today is both to present this book, to share with you some of the graphic experiments we've been doing, but also I will try to make the link again with your general the general topic of the seminar, which is the soil, although not all the maps are actually linked to the soil, but the focus is very much the soil. So just a few things about myself. I just try to see whether I can. I just try to see how I can make the next. Sorry, it doesn't. Just need to find the control of my presentation to see how I can move in it. Sorry, I'm not used to that.
Sorry to interrupt you. If it's easier for you to put it smaller on the screen, the participants can always zoom out and see the slide.
Okay.
So just choose the way that is easier for you to navigate through your presentation. Thank you.
Thank you. It's just that I need to find the keynote on the computer somehow.
I guess if you click on presentation, you will be able to on the
Yeah, it's sorry. It's just the my computer seems to be just a bit at the moment. I will find it. No worries. I just need to restart Keynote. Yeah, I think it works better. Okay, I'll do that way. Sorry about the interruption. So just a few words about my own background, which is in literature and the history of science in the 17th century. And the reason why I start with that is just to situate a little bit myself and the fact that I have long been interested in the question of representation of the earth, representation of the soil, in terms of pictorial, literary, architectural, cartographic representations of the world, of the earth, especially. As a historian of science, I worked in particular on the history of cosmology at the time of the Copernican Revolution, at the turn of the 16th and 17th century. So it might sound very remote from our discussion today, but in fact, one of the things I've discovered through this historical background is the fact that the change of the conception of the cosmos could only be achieved through the making of new kinds of representations, new kinds of images. And what I was so interested in is the fact that it's only through the alliances between different disciplines, through the combination of the skills and practices of astronomers, philosophers, painters, artists, writers, that the Copernican cosmos could actually become tangible, shareable. And of course, as we know, we are living through a time that in many ways recalls the period of the cosmological revolution. And what is so fascinating today is to see that our conception of the Earth is undergoing a radical shift. We understand, thanks to contemporary biology and anthropology in particular, that the space we inhabit, the terrestrial space, is not an environment in the sense of an inert container. And I think Kuhn's presentation was so telling about it. What is around us is actually constantly produced by various forms of life. And we also understand, and this is more tragic, that our relationship to the Earth as an unlimited resource is not sustainable, that we live on a damaged planet, in the words of Anatsin. And this is a slide where I just refer to this beautiful book, Art of Living on a Damaged Planet, and also the Feral Atlas, which is a book, but also a website that is free access on internet. So, in fact, we are experiencing those profound transformations in the way we conceive our relationship with the Earth, but yet we lack the images to think about them. And that's something which is very much the focus of my research, and also of my theatre, I must say. It's always the same question: how to reconfigure our images of the Earth, of the soil, in order to change our relationship to it. So that's what we tried to do in this book, Terra Forma. And what I will try to do is to share with you some of the maps, strange maps you will see. I'm not sure we can call them maps, but potential cartographies. And our hope by making this atlas, this book, was that those maps, those drawings, those diagrams would be used, discussed. That's why I'm so grateful for this invitation this morning. So the context of the book, as we all know, is the notion of the disputed notion of the Anthropocene. But more interestingly, the idea that the Anthropocene, sorry, it's a bit blurred, but it will come back better maybe on this one. The idea of the Anthropocene is very much linked to the soil, as you might know. I'm very interested in the geological definition of the Anthropocene as defined, for instance, by Jan Zalazewicz, who is a stratigrapher, and he's somebody who tries to situate the Anthropocene in a as a very specific place in the soil. So what is fascinating for me is to see that beyond, you know, the big anthropological philosophical debate about the relevance of the concept of the Anthropocene, because of course the Anthropos is too vague and all that, we know that there is this sense of, I mean, the fact that the soil is actually a very good indicator of the moment in geohistory where new things appear in the soil, like plastic, coal, and all those things can actually be seen and will be seen for a long time. So that's a an interesting, I think, take at the concept. Just a bit more background. The rest of the context of my work is very much my work with Bruno Latour, and the fact that we've been trying together to experience, to test new ways of representing the Earth in relation to the new definitions given by the Earth System Science, ESS. And this is what Bruno calls a Gaiagraphy. The point is how to change, again, our relationship to the Earth and especially to the soil through all the possible means and medium, theater, images, narratives, maps. And this little photo, you can see Bruno slightly hidden behind the very famous Earthrise image. And one of the arguments that we share is that the problem of our relationship to the Earth might come from the fact that we are used to see it from far away, either in fiction, like in my 17th century astronomers, or through those images that NASA has produced and our wonderful techniques. But we are used to see the Earth and the globe from far away, from a very remote point of view. And of course, what we need is new ways to approach it. That's we tried. So in those theatrical project. This one is called Inside, how to go back inside, again, the soil, how to go back inside the Earth. So that was the first conference performance we made together. And one of the recurring joke, in a way, and problems of this performance is to say that, well, it's very difficult actually to give an image. And that here you can see Bruno pointing at the soil in the performance, and he points towards this very blurred image, which is again an attempt at representing what he calls Gaia, or the critical zone, or the Earth, depending on, or the terrestrial, depending on the context, depending on the books. But again, the point is that it is very difficult to find images which are not images of the surface, which are images of the depth. So that's the starting point of Terra Forma. I can just read this little hypothesis. If some of the phenomena we are witnessing, soil erosion, depletion of resources, acceleration of urban space-time, intensification of polluted areas, if some of those phenomena escape us by their scale, duration and scope, it's through the development of our techniques of representation that we can hope to better understand them. Or at least it's one of the ways by which we could hope to change our maybe relationship to the Earth. So the last bit of context, because it's important, I think, for our discussion this morning, I wanted to share with you, is the fact that before working together for Terra Forma, Alexandra and Axel, two landscape architects. They worked for 10 years in an architecture agency. And like many of the young architects today, they were asked to work on ruined landscapes, on damaged territories, most of the time. Most of their projects were related to post-industrial sites, wastelands, polluted lands. And the questions they had to solve was always how to re-inhabit these devastated landscapes. But the reason why we started to work together is that they were very frustrated with the available tools. So we decided that, I mean, why were they frustrated? First of all, because the maps, as we know them, describe, as you know, a space available to humans, mostly, which they can use and occupy. So one of our first starting point was to say, look, the maps we have are actually empty of living things. They represent a surface, supposedly a soil, which has nothing to do in reality with the soil, with how it's made and what, with what it is. So to describe the earth again in a different way could mean, first of all, to try to fill in the maps, to bring back into them the multiple life forms which have been excluded from our geographical and cartographic imagination. In a way, we could say that to explore the earth again is to try to inhabit a space that is already inhabited by other. Being many is a very good title of the session today. I found it's not me, but thanks for suggesting that title. So yes, what does that mean to be many? And what does that mean in terms of our images, our representations? How does that mean to share the space with non-human entities and to share it with the living things which are terraforming it with us? And here, this is the title of the book, Terraforma. You might have noticed the shift in meaning that we are making with the term terraforming. Terraforming is generally used as an ultra-technical process. It's also a very well-known science fiction term. For instance, the terraforming of Mars, which is supposed to transform its atmosphere and its climate to make it habitable by humans. And of course, you have understood that, on the contrary, the way we use the word terraforming here is to define a very terrestrial activity. The fact of terraforming the soil, the earth, the critical zone with other living beings. So that's the way we used to make maps in a very traditional way with a, you know, a very projection kind of tools. And the way we tried to re-describe the soil, the earth, was first of all to take it as a terra incognita, unknown earth, unknown planet in a way. And in order to do that, we used somebody I like very much called Robert Hooke, who is a 17th century scientist. And he said, look, with my instruments, with my microscope, I can rediscover the earth. What we think we know around us is actually a complete terra incognita. So our project started like that. It's a thought experiment. Let's imagine that the earth is an unknown planet. How can we rediscover it? Or how can we discover it again, differently? Can we renew the images that we have of it? So we decided to equip ourselves with new tools, very much inspired by Hooke. And again, that's the historian of science in me talking. But we use as an inspiration the history of optics, and we decided to make different lenses, and those lenses are the sommaires of Terraforma. They are the little models that we tried to devise in order to see the soil around us differently. So the manual, the book, and I won't go through all of the 7 chapters, of course, but just to show you a few of them, the book is structured into 7 chapters, and each chapter presents a kind of lens, a model, and a map, which is the result of an invention, I could say, of a graphic model to visualize a specific problem. Each of these models slightly modifies the traditional tools of cartography. The 7 models are soil, the first one. We start with the soil. The second is point of life, then living landscapes, then borders, resources, space-time, and memories. And each of them explore the way in which the living things trace their territories, cohabit, develop thick borders, or adjust their rhythms of life. And they are, in a way, models for redescribing territories, no longer through stable cartographic codes that show only topographic elements, but through the movements of various forms of life. That's the idea. Let me go into one of them. That's the one you saw already in the first slide, which is the soil model and the soil map. So normally in the book, you just have the first of all the tools. We explain exactly how we made our kind of graphic tools and lenses, and then there is the map. But in this slide, I show them together. The point is basically, well, I should have shown you that first. The point is to reveal an invisible world. And again, there is the question of what do we know about the soil? How to reveal the depth that we never see normally? The second point, of course, is linked, is to overcome the flattening nature of cartography. The third, as I explained, is to repopulate the maps by trying to represent the diversity of active terraforming agents in the territory. So the whole point is to transform the gaze, of course, our gaze, but maybe more deeply, I would say, to allow the incredible project like Kuhn's project to be shareable, and it's really a way to renew our relationship to the things, living things, which make the with which we share the earth. I show you that quickly, which is the way, which is the chemical valley, La Vallée de la Chimie, near Lyon, which is an extremely polluted area, as you might know. And the reason why I show you that is to show you that all those very abstract, I mean, they look very abstract, our maps and our models, they actually all come from field work. Alexandra and Axel have collected for years data in the chemical valley, Vallée de la Chimie. And again, they didn't have the tools to represent this polluted soil. How do you represent that? And in fact, the trick we found was to create a model that works like a upturned glove. You imagine that the earth is actually returned. The atmosphere has been placed in the center. The deep earth, which is normally at the center, is now around at the periphery of the map. And what remains is actually the critical zone, the soil, basically. And why did we do that? In order to see better. You could say that it's a kind of anamorphosis. What we discovered by doing that, and again, this is the map of the soil. So the atmosphere is here. And the idea was to fill the paper sheet, with only the soil, mostly the soil. Something that normally we don't see. And the aim is, why don't we see the soil normally? It's a problem of scale. Because as you know, first of all, the critical zone is minuscule in relation to the globe. So when you represent the globe normally, you just have a very, very, very thin crust. But the point is that this critical zone, I should have defined that. It's another way to say the soil. It goes from the upper layer of the atmosphere to the rocks where you don't have life anymore. So it's really the place where all life and all its resources are concentrated. And it's not bigger than a few kilometers. Everything happens in this very thin layer. And this new kind of frame of reference that we suggest has many consequences. For one, it makes the soil visible as a palimpsest by bringing to light the stratification of land use. And in fact, you can see that the reach of human influence is not only horizontal, but also vertical. So we try to show how far the man human action goes, and it really has penetrated the ground to the deepest strata. Then the model makes it possible to visually represent the constant flux between different levels of the ground, and this is also quite interesting for us when we work with scientists. It's difficult to represent the fluidity, which is actually in the soil. Normally, you don't associate fluidity and the earth. But in fact, you can see, it's not very clear. I'm sorry, I should make a kind of, no, I don't have a zoom of that. Sometimes what we try to represent here is the fact that a landslide has caused two strata to meet, for instance, two epochs that should never have met. Or we try to find to show why toxic substances have infiltrated the soil, how they have contaminated deep groundwater. The second consequence of this model is that it makes the boomerang effect tangible. In fact, by putting the atmosphere at the center, it emphasizes the fact that everything that is dispersed into the atmosphere returns to us because we live in a closed system. And again, what is interesting, I think, with this idea of critical zone is that the soil and the atmosphere are actually together. They are where really things happen. You can't really divide them. I wanted to say. I'm not sure I have much more time. Maybe I do have a bit more time. In that case, I will just maybe show you a second map, which is related to our common topic today, which is the map called Living Landscape. What we tried to do in this one was to remove the background completely, what we call in French le fond de carte, which is normally how we see the soil. But we decided, as a kind of, experimental move, to remove this background so that the topographical elements disappear. The question then is, what will build the landmarks? Now this background is free, and in fact what it shows is only the relationship between living things and the territory. So it's a very a strange way to represent something, but just imagine that you take as the basis of your representation the way the bodies are moving and living. And the idea is that the moving and living bodies become the driving force behind the map. So what we do actually by removing the background is that we obtain a liquid space, and it opens up to other kinds of circulation, new spaces of encounters. And in fact, the map becomes the representation of interactions that inhabit the space. What we did, I can't enter into detail, but it's a bit like a portland, like a navigation map that Renaissance sailors were using. Around the map, you have the starting point of each point of life, each living thing, and then we just try to follow them through their movement. Here you can see it better, maybe. So we follow the movements and lifelines of humans and non-humans that make our space, so to speak. Because again, the living beings, they do much more than simply move into space. They actually manipulate air and matter and soil to create the conditions for their survival. They create the space, in fact. They make a living map, you could say. So this changes the status of the map, of course, because it's no longer a fixed drawing. Of course, it's only a provisional map. It can't be, it's already wrong, this map, as soon as you start to draw it, in a way. So you need to make constantly new tools. But this changes also the status of space. As I said at the beginning, it's no longer a simple container, but it's a living landscape. It's a living space composed of a thousand superimposition, overlapping actions of the beings that surround us. I can't really show you much more, but just very quickly, that's the model and map for borders. How to imagine borders not as thin lines, but as space of inhabiting. Then that's a map that tries to include time to represent time-space in a city. This is the 10th arrondissement of Paris, strangely enough. And that's a map about resources. And again, maybe I can say a few words about that. The idea of resources was that the way we use natural resources until now is by suddenly sucking completely one resource somewhere. So we tried to represent that, this kind of ventouse effect. And the idea was to change again our representation. What if we don't consider resources as something that you can just take out completely, but more like a series of a variety of resources that which are everywhere on the territory. But the last map I will conclude with that, I wanted to share with you is the last one called Memories. And it's less a map that a compass, a way to try to orientate ourselves. The idea of this one is that how can we actually imagine the habitability of territories that are sometimes so damaged that rehabilitation is not possible or is not even desirable in the short term? So this map in which we try to transform all the ruins, which are on the left side, all the ruins into possible signs for the future. So it's a map about rehabilitation, about rehabiting places. But of course, depending on what is in the soil, if it's about nuclear waste, for instance, of course, the idea of re-inhabiting this territory is very, very, very remote. But sometimes you can really reverse a ruin into something positive if you make a certain kind of work. So this is a way, again, to to try to represent the problem we have with re-inhabiting a ruined soil, a ruined landscape. And just for the pleasure, I conclude with this representation of the soil, which you might know by Athanasius Kircher in the 17th century. And you can see how much we have been influenced by this completely crazy picture of the earth as, again, as a very organic and living body. But I will stop now. Thank you very much.